It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, some of the public water systems in eastern Wisconsin have higher levels of strontium than anywhere else in the nation, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. We'll find out what this means for Wisconsinites.
First, with less than 2 weeks before Wisconsin holds its presidential primary, candidates and their representatives are already crisscrossing the state with their campaign messages. WPR News reporter Chuck Cormack has been at several campaign stops already, and he joins us now from our studios in Milwaukee. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So big news today. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are going to be making stops in Wisconsin next week, but we're already seeing a lot of pre-primary action. Today, you are with Chelsea Clinton. Can you tell us about that visit?
That's right. She started her public part of her day in Milwaukee and then went on to Waukesha and is due in Madison. And in Milwaukee, she spoke at a Hillary Clinton campaign office on the north side of Milwaukee, about 100 people or so, talked about why she thought her mom would be a great president, comparing somewhat to Democratic challenger Bernie Sanders, but also focusing quite a bit on Hillary Clinton's comparing her to Republican candidates. Ms. Clinton, Chelsea, sat down during much of her address because she mentioned she's pregnant. She's also the mother of about a 17-month-old, so she wanted to make sure she was comfortable talking. And then she talked with news reporters afterwards and sort of addressed the motherhood issue as it connects to the presidential campaign of her mother.
And what was her primary message to voters in Wisconsin?
Well, that her mother's policies would be better for families, that would be better on the issue of children's rights, of women's rights, of protecting folks from gun violence was issued. She was asked about police community relations in Milwaukee, and Chelsea Clinton mentioned the Dontre Hamilton case and suggested ways to improve police community relations from the federal level was to provide more funding, federal funding for police training, but also more education and mental health issues to try to make sure people in poverty were more likely to succeed and maybe less likely to have the police looking over them.
And Chuck, you were there. We have a little bit about what Chelsea Clinton had to say today. Here it is.
What matters most to me now as a mom myself is that my mom has been fighting for and making progress on issues that really matter to me, whether that's early childhood education, gun control, health care, and as you pointed out, she's a former Secretary of State. It matters to me also that she knows how to keep our country safe.
So interesting that so far we have Chelsea Clinton, we have Ted Cruz, John Kasich, Donald Trump coming to Wisconsin. So far not Hillary Clinton herself. Did Chelsea Clinton talk at all about whether Hillary Clinton would be visiting Wisconsin?
I asked her about that. She said she would think that Hillary Clinton would be coming in. Now this interview was, this meeting with the media was before Bernie Sanders around midday announced that he's definitely coming to Madison on Saturday. So you'd think if Senator Sanders is coming in that former Secretary of State Clinton would arrive at some point too, but I don't think we've heard quite yet about that.
Now, on the GOP side of things, Ted Cruz has stops in Dane and Janesville on his schedule today, but he was also in Pewaukee last night. How did Ted Cruz connect with voters there?
Well, he was invited by a conservative talk show host who doesn't care for Donald Trump, apparently, and so Cruz came in and was interviewed by this host, and not a lot of critical questions for Senator Cruz, but got a pretty good reception from a few hundred people in the audience there at Pewaukee as he talked about tax changes, about carpet bombing, ISIS, Islamic extremists, and so on. So Cruz got a good reception from the folks in the room there in Pewaukee.
And again, you were present last night in Pewaukee. Here's a clip of Ted Cruz.
I agree with Bernie Sanders. I agree when Bernie Sanders says that Washington is corrupt, the fix is in, and you've got politicians who are cutting deals that benefit big business and giant corporations and Wall Street at the expense of working men and women.
Wow, so is that a surprise? The clip opens there with, I agree with Bernie Sanders
well,
from the leading...
a little bit. He was getting at why he hasn't gotten certain endorsements. He's been backed by Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney, but there's some other senators in Washington in the Republican side have not come out for Ted Cruz, and he was sort of suggesting, you know, he used the word corrupt, pretty strong claim there, explaining why he's sort of a badge of honor that he hasn't gotten some of these endorsements. So he's trying to be independent as well, but a bit more Republican mainstream than Donald Trump appears to be.
We're talking with WPR's Chuck Kornbach right now. He's WPR's reporter in Milwaukee, talking about campaign stops in Wisconsin as the state gets ready to host its primary on April 5th. And Chuck, you were also covering Ohio Governor John Kasich, who was in Milwaukee. Now, most polls have him trailing Ted Cruz in Wisconsin, also trailing frontrunner Donald Trump considerably. So what was his goal here in Wisconsin?
Well, he appeared with former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson and also former Governor Scott McCallum, sort of to suggest that this is a guy, Kasich, who has gotten things done in Ohio. He's cut taxes, he's affected government spending, made changes in welfare and so on. And he's saying he can do that. He's done it at both the gubernatorial level, and in his preceding years, Kasich was a strong budget hawk, if you will, in Congress. So he's saying he's got this track record, but so far it hasn't connected with an overwhelming number of voters.
And he was asked, you know, are you going to drop out? What did he say?
Well, he said he was asked if he would drop out before the Wisconsin primary on April 5th. He said definitely not. There's no reason to. He claimed his fundraising has gone up. He's getting more people to the rallies. And he did get quite a nice reception from about 200 people in suburban Milwaukee yesterday. So whether he stays in, it seems he's going to stay in. He's announced now campaign events in Wisconsin next week. So it appears he's definitely staying in through at least the 5th. Then he's saying he can do better than Ted Cruz can in some eastern state primaries. And, you know, Kasich and Cruz's goal is to try to tie up Trump before the GOP convention and then have a delegate fight in Cleveland.
Well, in Wisconsin so far, it looks like Donald Trump is looking vulnerable, certainly in southeastern Wisconsin, and he will be showing up in Wisconsin pretty soon. What do we know about his planned visit so far?
Donald Trump, Janesville so far, he's, as you were saying, southeastern Wisconsin seems to be more establishment Republican areas, and that's why Cruz and Kasich seem to be battling there. Trump, a little more independent, going after, you would think in Janesville, more the blue-collar vote, both Republicans and Democrats.
Now, protests continue to follow Donald Trump events. Are you getting any sort of inkling that we could see something similar here in Wisconsin, maybe in Janesville?
Well, I suppose it could be. There's also a line of thought that if Trump's negatives in the polling continue, then Democrats don't really need to point out what they don't like about Donald Trump, at least at this point. Now, that might change, of course, by this summer if he's the Republican nominee. But for now, everything is possible. There's certainly debate over whether, for example, Milwaukee Sheriff David Clark, who's criticized the protesters, should be in charge of any security at Trump events, et cetera. So it's possible.
And in the meantime, supporters happy that he's coming. Here's one of his supporters, Deanne Price.
You know, he says a lot of times, I could pretty much do whatever I want. I could pretty much say whatever I want. We just like what he stands for, just in general, that he stands for the people and nobody's going to buy him. He's not a puppet.
Yeah, what do you make of that clip?
Well, that was outside Trump's new campaign office in Menominee Falls, Milwaukee suburb. He's also opened an office in Appleton. And it was part of a group of people that seemed to really want to talk to the media about Donald Trump. Sometimes you get the vibe like, no, I don't want to talk to you. But in this case, several people came forward and wanted to talk. They're suggesting they're not being heard by the major political parties. And even though Trump is running as a Republican, he's more stressing a more independent tone. So, you know, these folks want to come forward and talk. Now, they also talked some about their support for guns and their concerns about immigration, some of the controversial things that have come up. But they also sort of got the message that these folks, you know, haven't been heard and think Donald Trump is the one that will listen to them.
And Chuck, just briefly as we wrap up, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan has been critical of Donald Trump's campaign recently. Do you think that there's any sort of kind of retribution there in Donald Trump choosing Janesville, his home turf?
Well, it's possible. Ted Cruz, though, is down in Janesville today as well. And so, it may partly be Paul Ryan. Here's a message for you. But it may also be, listen, there's these former auto workers and other blue-collar folks in Janesville. We want to reach out to them and get them over to the Republican side or keep them on the Republican side. I talked to a Teamster at Menominee Falls who said he was voting for Trump, and Teamsters usually go for Democrats.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR News reporter Chuck Kornbach on the primary campaign trail here in Wisconsin.
A series from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism takes an in-depth look at drinking water problems in the state.
One of the most recent installments of the Failure at the Faucet series examines strontium levels in Wisconsin's drinking water. Data from the Environmental Protection Agency shows that some public water systems in eastern Wisconsin have some of the highest levels of strontium in the country.
Jane Roberts joins us now. She's helped to report the Failure at the Faucet series for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Currently, she's associate editor of Undark Magazine, a new online magazine launched at MIT. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So first, let's start. We hear a lot about things like mercury and lead. Those are much better known. What exactly is strontium?
So it's a naturally occurring element, and it comes from the bedrock and dissolves into the groundwater. So I think some people get confused and think that we're talking about strontium-90, the radioactive element, but this is a naturally occurring element.
So where does the Environmental Protection Agency stand currently on regulating strontium in drinking water?
So it was part of their unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, and they made a decision to start looking into regulation, but in January they decided to delay that so that they could do more research, because currently there isn't that much data on the effects.
So you said that strontium is naturally occurring, but it's also considered a contaminant. Is that a usual situation with things that we find in our drinking water?
So I guess some people, there's some contention on whether we should use the word contaminant. So it is naturally occurring, but it is also something that can cause problems if ingested. So I guess there are other things like that as well.
And so you said that there can be problems depending on the amount of strontium that's ingested. What are some of the health concerns that people are worried about when they find out that there might be more strontium in their water than they should be getting?
So the main concerns are for infants and children and adolescents whose bones are still growing, because the way that strontium works, it mimics calcium. It's chemically similar. So it gets taken up into the bones and can cause strontium rickets, which is a thickening of the bones, and can also cause tooth mottling, which is problems in the tooth enamel.
And what happens with rickets? What's the ultimate effect of that?
It can cause children to be bow-legged and have other bone growth deformities.
So you say that it mimics calcium. So are they closely related to each other?
Yes, they're similar in chemical composition. So the way that they get taken up by the body is kind of the same.
So I know that one of the reasons that the milk is vitamin D enriched is because it helps us absorb more of the calcium. So are there unintended consequences in how we try to make sure that kids are getting the calcium they need? And if there's too much strontium, then it's kind of a side effect of that.
Well, I spoke with someone at the Department of Health Services, and they said that if you get enough calcium and vitamin D, those things can counteract the effects of strontium. So it's sort of just dependent on your nutritional makeup. It doesn't necessarily mean if you have an elevated level of strontium in your water that all of that is going to be taken up by the body. There's different factors that kind of go into that.
And with the medical professionals that you spoke to, is there also a concern for adults, or is this really more for bodies that are still developing?
It's more for bodies that are still developing. I've seen some reports that older adults can actually benefit from strontium if they, because they, you know, it can help if you've got like osteoporosis and things like that. But I don't think that would be something that you would want to get out of your drinking water. So I guess the taking it from the drinking water is the problems are more for children.
And so are there any current guidelines for how much, for what level is safe consumption of strontium by young people, by the EPA or by any medical professionals?
There is a recommended limit of 4 milligrams per liter. That's the long-term thing, so that would be 4 milligrams per liter per day. And then there's 25 milligrams per liter, which is a short-term advisory, so you should never have more than that at one time.
And so how do we go about calculating the concentration of strontium in drinking water?
I'm not exactly sure how they calculate for doing the actual testing. I know that to come up with those amounts, they consider body weight and how much water you're actually consuming to come up with those recommended limits.
So we are talking with Jane Roberts right now, former journalism student at UW, who helped to report the failure at the faucet series for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And we are talking about the most recent report in failure at the faucet, which is about strontium. So how much strontium is present in Wisconsin's drinking water, and how much does it vary from region to region?
I guess the big thing that I found in the EPA data was that a lot of the tests came back extremely over the limit of the 4 milligrams per liter or the 25 milligrams per liter. There were some in Brookfield, Germantown, other places like that where they were as high as, I think they were over, some of them were over 50. 53 milligrams per liter was in Germantown. So, It does vary, but there tends to be a high concentration in the eastern part of the state because of the bedrock that's there, and that's something that professor at Green Bay, John Luchai, found in his study of private wells.
And tell us more about what he did. Was he sampling private wells just in that area of the state or in a larger area?
He was trying to find, look for where it occurs the most, and he knows that it occurs in the deep bedrock of that part of the state, so he was doing most of the testing there.
So as we said, it's a naturally occurring element, and especially people who are using private wells, that water is coming through or is being housed in that bedrock. So if there is a concern for a particular community or a particular homeowner that has a higher level of strontium than would be ideal, and this is water that young children and as we said, people who are still in the growth process are using, what are the options for removing or at least reducing that level of strontium in the drinking water?
So the solution is actually pretty simple. People can install a water softener, which takes out the calcium, magnesium, and strontium, replaces it with sodium, sort of like an ion exchange. So that's sort of been the recommendation for people who have found that they've had elevated levels of strontium is to install a water softener. Some people have a concern with that if they have if they're on a sodium reduced diet, but then you can also install a reverse osmosis system, which will then take out that strontium. So I guess it's a pretty simple fix. Some of the concerns are for the EPA testing was all of municipal water supplies, and so those people, if they did come up with a regulation, then the municipal water might have to start treating water, but that would be a very costly thing to do.
So it's interesting to me because it sounds like, first of all, it's not an issue for everyone who might have that excess strontium, and that, as you said, it's a relatively easy fix, which with being able to use a water softener and then maybe a filter if the sodium is an issue. But what it comes down to is actually having that knowledge that you have that higher level of strontium. So what's the process? Say someone now is concerned about this. They're in that part of the state. They have a well. How can they go about getting their water tested?
You can actually order a testing kit from the State Lab of Hygiene, and it's a testing kit for heavy metals, so it includes other things as well. That runs about $60, and there's a number, if you go onto their website, you can order it, or you can go in person. There's their office in Madison, and you can go to their customer service desk and ask about it.
Great. And also, you talked to some people about their concerns for their drinking water. What did you hear from those Wisconsinites?
I talked to someone in Sheboygan County who was very concerned. He's got small children, and he had been recommended to get a water softener, but he's decided to just drink bottled water just because he's sort of doesn't trust what he's been told. Other people have just installed the water softeners and reverse osmosis and have seen a decrease in the strontium that they've had. But I talked to a lot of county health officials, and they said they haven't, before I had written this story, they hadn't really heard much concern. I think probably just because people weren't aware of the problem in Wisconsin.
I do think that, you know, there's the, you talked about the person who's using bottled water. Instead, that certainly adds up on the grocery bill, but there are also the costs associated with, say, a water softener or a filter. Do you know of any programs that, that could help people who maybe can't afford those improvements to their home?
The people that I had talked to at the time, they said that there wasn't any sort of subsidy for that. So, yeah, that is a cost that people would have to incur if they were going to install those things.
Well, Jane, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Jane Roberts. She helped to report the failure at the faucet series for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Currently, she's associate editor of Undark Magazine, a new online magazine launched at MIT. You can find a link to the report on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, our guest says unmarried women in America did more than change the social fabric of the country. They helped to change the course of history. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There's an observation made by the French writer Simone de Beauvoir that women, by definition, are married or have been or plan to be or suffer from not being. And according to our next guest, marriage used to be the end of the story for women over the years, an end kind of to the narrative arc.
But these days, only 20% of Americans are married by the age of 29, compared to about 60% in 1960. In her new book, All the Single Ladies, Rebecca Traister looks at the influence of unmarried life on women's options, on society as a whole, and on what happens now that marriage isn't always a given for a new generation.
Rebecca Traister joins us now. She has written for Elle, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and her new book is called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that it used to be that marriage was kind of the end of the story for women. You looked at literature, Anne of Green Gables, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Joe from Little Women. What did their stories say about the role of marriage?
Well, interestingly, their stories were ones where marriage was both the end of the story and it was necessarily the beginning of female adulthood. So I kick off the book by looking at my childhood heroines. So yes, Laura and Mary and Jo March and Shirley Jane Eyre. And those stories, those books were coming of age books, Bildungsroman. And interestingly, for women in previous generations, girlhood, when they were in moments where they were able to get educations, where they had hopes and friends and a degree of freedom, even in their youth, that's where their stories were told, where they got into trouble and scrapes and were badly behaved and had adventures. And that's what we read about in those coming-of-age tales. And then they all concluded with marriage. And we know it's the same, for example, for Disney movies and for many of Shakespeare's comedies, that they end with marriage. The happy ending is so often marriage. But for women in particular, and especially for those kinds of heroines, it's interesting because it meant adulthood. And that's because for so long in history, marriage and marriage to men who could be earners, who could make money, who could have financial security. Marriage was a necessity for women who didn't have that same kind of opportunity to be economically independent on their own or to have autonomous sex lives or to have children outside of marriage. So to be an adult woman for a lot of our history meant having to be a wife in order to have some of those kinds of stability and socially sanctioned freedoms. And so the beginning of adulthood was often kicked off by marriage, and then for women often defined by marriage. And so that was the end of the coming of age tales of my young heroine and the beginning of adulthood for a lot of women.
And for women, that age where you got married was pretty young. It used to be between, what, 20, 22 years old. So there wasn't a whole lot of life lived on one's own before then.
Well, as I said, it was pretty difficult to live life on one's own if you were a woman. If the opportunity for education and for earning wages was limited, I mean, we still live in a world where women's pay equity isn't protected or guaranteed or mandated by the government. We know that women's fields tend to pay less than male-dominated fields, even today. And of course, those circumstances were so much worse just a few decades ago. You know, there wasn't as much ability to live outside of marriage for so long. And so, yes, by necessity, once you were out of, for so many women, dependence on a man was necessary. So once you were out of your father's house as a child, there was a necessity. You sort of had to be attached to a man of some sort in order to have economic stability. So even women who weren't married in earlier eras were often dependent on brothers or brothers-in-law or still living with fathers, the kind of people who could earn money. And secure some kind of stability for women. And so, yes, the marriage age for more than for 100 years that they counted, the median age of first marriage for women was just between 20 and 22. That was about average. It was the start of adulthood. But today it's over 27 nationally, and it's higher than that in many cities.
So, Rebecca, when did that start to turn around? Because it has been a radical shift, not just in the age that people get married, but in the choice whether to get married at all.
Right. Well, it really started to shift in mass numbers in the 1990s. There have been other eras that I write about in my book, including the 19th century, when gender ratios shifted. For example, all the men moved west. In the 19th century, and there were a lot of women on the East Coast who didn't marry at all because there weren't husbands. But then there were all kinds of pressures applied, and marriage became reestablished in the 20th century, early marriage, as the norm for women. And so the contemporary wave of singlehood for women really kicked off in mass numbers in the 1990s. It was 1990 where that median age of first marriage that had remained between 20 and 22 for so long, for a century or more, jumped to over 23, which was a big shift. And it was in the 90s that we saw what sociologists call the great crossover, where the average age of first marriage actually went higher than the average age of first birth. So you saw an increase in women having children outside of marriage. And that was all happening in the early 90s.
So I guess the question is, what happened in the 90s to make that shift possible?
Well, a lot of things. A lot of very consciously political movements of the mid-20th century, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the sexual revolution, the gay rights movement, all those things had this profound impact on the conditions for women. So, for example, the ability to better control reproduction through legalized access to contraception and through legalized abortion. The more women flooding into workplaces, Title IX, that meant that more women could experience higher education, could go into colleges, could compete in colleges, could compete in the workforce. You know, things like the Equal Credit Opportunity Act in 1974 that gave women something greater to equal opportunity economically. Those things created conditions for women to be able to live outside of marriage. They also did something. Those revolutions of the 1970s led to a big spike in divorce rates for traditionally married hetero couples. And those divorce rates really spiked in the late 70s and the 80s. And so you had a generation of people coming in the 90s who, A, had the opportunity to live. Women could do other things with their lives besides get married. They could have careers, they could earn money, they could have a liberated sex life. And so they didn't have to get married. And also many of them had reckoned with the dissolution of their own parents' marriages and saw marriage as an institution of variable quality, not something they had to do, but something that if they did, they wanted to make sure it was good and stable. And that often takes longer to find.
We're talking to Rebecca Traister right now. She's the author of the new book called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. And you spoke with a lot of feminists to write this book, and it sounded like the second wave feminists were kind of saying, oh, you didn't just invent all these options in the 90s. We get some credit for this. Who does get the credit in terms of the feminists?
Well, the story of women moving closer to independence is a story that, as I learned as I was writing the book and as I describe in the book, is a history that's woven throughout all of American history. So if you want to start giving credit, we should go back to Susan B. Anthony, who gave a speech in 1877, who said, you know, about the homes of single women. Or even before that, there were women writing at the Revolution about the connection between personal liberty and the kind of fight, you know, the young United States was having over its notion of equality and representation versus the impositions of the marital contract. So the credit extends way beyond. But it is true that lots of women in the 1970s who were part of the women's movement said, objected to marriage, and said it was, called it a patriarchal institution, and that there were numbers of women who abstained from it or delayed it to prioritize their career or their educations. But that wasn't, that was a politicized choice in many cases, and it wasn't made in the mass numbers that are happening today. What's interesting about the women who are delaying or abstaining from marriage today is that they're not necessarily doing it out of any kind of self-conscious political action. They're not even necessarily making an active choice of rejecting marriage. They're simply living in a new way. This radical idea of disestablishing marriage as the central organizing force of women's lives has now been adopted as a mass behavior, where it's not that you're saying, oh, I reject marriage because it's a patriarchal institution, or I don't believe in marriage, or, you know, you're just, you don't have to get married if you don't meet a person whom you want to marry. And that is radical. It's radical, but it's not a self-conscious political movement.
And you point out that single women today, I mean, it's not a one-dimensional story. Single women today are still more likely to live in poverty than men. They earn less than men on the dollar. So is single life for women harder than it is for men?
Well, it is. But I argue in the book that it's harder in large part because we still don't have social and economic policies in place to support women living independently. Our country, its civic institutions and its laws and its tax benefits and its housing benefits, and has been set up with the assumption that Americans live in early married hetero units. And so you see men, and especially white men in this country, enjoy a series of tax breaks and historically have enjoyed housing subsidies, and infrastructure has helped their businesses, all these kinds of benefits that have accrued to white men. And it was assumed that women were their mates and doing the kind of domestic work, taking care of the children, having children, and were at home and were not earners. We're not living that way anymore. But we don't have policies in place that acknowledge women as being equal earners in the public space. So we don't have things like paid leave, because the government is still assuming that when women have children, they're at home, not in a workplace. So we don't have paid leave. We don't have paid sick days, because we assume that there's a class of Americans who are going to just be at home when a kid is sick or when an aged parent is sick and someone needs to care for them. We assume we have a class of unpaid caretakers, wives. But we don't anymore. We have school days that let out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and have long spring breaks. Many of us probably have kids who are on spring break right now. The assumption, who's going to take care of those kids? The assumption is there's a kind of American there to take care of those kids. That's not the way Americans are living right now. And so it is absolutely true that it is economically challenging for women to live unmarried. But it's not necessarily the fact that they're unmarried. It's the fact that we don't have policies that assume that women are independent and equal entities in the public, professional, and economic sphere.
Rebecca Traister is with us right now. She's the author of the new book, All the Single Ladies. We're tracing the history of unmarried women in the United States.
And we want to hear from you. What do you have to say? How has not getting married affected your life? Do you think society is more accepting of women who are single by choice? If you are married, how did that decision affect the storyline of your life? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now with Rebecca Traister. She's the author of the new book, All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How has not getting married affected your life? Do you think it's more acceptable to decide not to get married today? Are there good role models today for single women with fulfilled, productive lives, maybe on TV or in books? Call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Rebecca, you write that single women over the years have used their time without marriage to change the social politics in the country, to affect a real lasting change in the country. How have single women influenced that course of history?
Well, the best example of that is from the 19th century, when all those men moved west and there, and so many of them were also killed during the Civil War. And there was a real husband shortage on the East Coast, especially for middle-class white women. Black women, marriage had not been legally recognized for enslaved people before emancipation. And then after emancipation, black marriage rates went way up because there was marital liberty. But for middle-class white women, they didn't marry as much in the middle to the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. And so there was a whole bunch of women for whom their lives were no longer taken over by wifely responsibility and maternal obligation. And instead, they turned their energies toward social reform movements, including abolition, suffrage, temperance, the labor movement. It was young, unmarried women working in factories and mills at the end of the 19th and beginning of 20th century who staged some of the first walkout strikes that led to the labor movement. It was women who founded so many colleges and settlement houses. Teaching became a profession that was conceived of expressly for unmarried women. And of course, this sort of culminated with the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1919 and its ratification in 1920. After that, there was some pressure put on women to go back into early married patterns. But the end of that 19th century was a real moment in which unmarried women powered so many disruptive social movements.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Joan on the line with us in Milwaukee. Joan, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to ask if in your book you've given any recognition to the Catholic sisters who went out west when it was still pretty wild, mm-hmm. and came all over the country and founded schools and hospitals and orphanages.
Joan, thanks. Rebecca, what about that?
I didn't write specifically about the Catholic sisters moving west, but it is pretty fascinating that historically there were so few off-ramps from the highway to marriage to a man. And Catholicism, the church, really offered for centuries before it was increasingly possible for women to remain unmarried. Turning to the convent was one of the only other possibilities for women. And so there is this tremendous and pretty radical history of nuns and the church and this other religious path that women were more able to take than they were to take simply an unmarried but secular path. So there is a tremendous history that I do touch on in the book of the role that the church has played for women as a kind of alternate option to marriage and one of the only alternate options.
Well, thank you for the question, Joan. And we're going to take a comment here, a question from Julie. She couldn't stay on the line, and she said, what about the role of lesbians and non-hetero women who have suffered because men have typically been seen as the breadwinners?
Well, the fascinating history of the move toward gay marriage and marriage equality, lots of people cast that as a sort of retro reinscription of this traditional institution, marriage, on people who have lived outside of traditional norms and sort of a move toward backward. But in fact, I see this, the move toward gay marriage and the legalization of gay marriage as working hand in hand with a hetero move away from marriage as the only central organizing force of women's lives, precisely because it makes marriage mean something different. Instead of an organizing structure for power that's divided between men and women, it becomes a different kind of connection between people and a different kind of set of emotional commitments. And so it's helping to redefine marriage. And of course, as we have more women living independently of it, on their own, in same-sex relationships, in same-sex marriages, what you're seeing is an expansion of opportunities, including economic opportunities for women, including those in same-sex partnerships where, yes, historically, if there wasn't a man involved, there was much more economic insecurity.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister right now, talking about the history of unmarried women in the United States. And Rebecca, is being a single woman later in life socially acceptable at this point, do you think, or seen as desirable? I know some journalists are writing about prejudice against single people as a group and also against older women, especially who are unmarried.
Well, it certainly gets harder and harder as you get older. Again, we don't have all kinds of policies that support extended life independent from marriage for women. And because so many people, many people do eventually marry, even though they're doing it at different points in life. So many of the women I spoke to did acknowledge that it becomes lonelier, the pressures applied become more intense as you get older, and as more of your peers marry. But there are so many women who are, I mean, this is changing around us all the time. So I think the experience of someone today who is in her 30s, who may be single into her 50s or 60s, might be different from a person who's currently in their 50s and 60s and single. But yes, there's no question there is still stigma. And Bella DiPaolo, who's written about sort of structural prejudice against single people, you know, what happens when you don't get the tax breaks, when you are subject to additional additional costs, like you always have to have a double hotel room, even if you're just one person sleeping in it. There are all kinds of ways in which the world is set up for married people that makes it a challenging place for people living singly. However, the numbers are growing so swiftly that I think we're seeing alterations in how we live. One of the challenges for people growing old outside of marriage, you know, has been issues of care and companionship. Increasingly, we're seeing people live communally, if not maritally, then with friends or peers with shared living spaces. You know, we are shifting to adjust to the new ways in which we're living. And so it is my hope that it will become easier for people who remain single deeper into their lives.
And Rebecca, we've only got about 20 seconds left here, but what do you consider to be the next frontier of this movement?
I think we need to see social policy shifts, and I hope we see them coming with the next election. Things like a raising of the minimum wage, paid parental leave, paid sick days, subsidized early childhood education, the kinds of policies that will better support adult female independence.
Thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Traister has written for Elle, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and she's the author of the new book called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Because it's a snowy and dreary day here in Wisconsin, we here at Central Time give you Hanson.
The song Mbop turns 20 years old today. Boy band Hanson wrote and played the song. They were all very young and had long blonde hair. I think only one of the Hanson brothers had a voice that had already changed at that point, which makes it pretty adorable.
Maybe too adorable, some would say, including Helen Hunt and Will Ferrell in this skit from Saturday Night Live.
Now you will suffer like we did.
Look, we're just trying to make fun catchy music.
No, no, don't try to pull that "we're just trying to make people happy" crap.
Put in your earplugs. You will now listen to this song for as long as it takes for you to feel the pain that we felt this past summer.
We play the song. It doesn't bother us.
Just listen!
Well, in any case, if you remember this song, you may be getting old. Mbop is 20 years old today. This is Central Time.